Welcome to Stories from the Shadows, haunted tales from the golden age of ghost stories and supernatural horror fiction. I'm Mordell, reading Sweeney Todd. Chapter 13. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yes. It is 9 at last. It strikes by old St. Dunstan's church clock, and in weaker strains, the chronometrical machine at the pie shop echoes the sound. What excitement there is to get at the pies when they shall come. Mrs. Lovett lets down the square, movable platform that goes on pulleys in the center. Some machinery, which requires only a handle to be turned, brings up 100 pies in a tray. These are eagerly seized by parties who have previously paid, and such a smacking of lips ensues as never was known. Down goes the platform for the next 100, and a gentlemanly man says, "Let me work the handle, Mrs. Lovett, if you please. It's too much for you, I'm sure." "Sir, you are very kind, but I never allow anybody on this side of the counter but my own people, sir. I can turn the handle myself, sir, if you please, with the assistance of this girl. Keep your distance, sir. Nobody wants your help." "But, my dear madam, only consider your delicacy. Really, you ought not to be permitted to work away like a slave at a winch-handle. Really, you ought not." The man who spoke thus obligingly to Mrs. Lovett was tall and stout, and the lawyer's clerks repressed the ire they otherwise would probably have given utterance to at thus finding anyone admiring their charming Mrs. Lovett. "Sir, I tell you once again that I don't want your help. Keep your distance, sir, if you please." "Now, don't get angry, fair one," said the man. "You don't know, but I might have made you an offer before I left the shop." "Sir," said Mrs. Lovett, drawing herself up and striking terror into the hearts of the limbs of the law. "Sir, what do you want? Say what you want and be served, sir, and then go. Do you want a pie, sir?" "A pie? Oh, dear, no. I don't want a pie. I would not eat one of the nasty things on any account. Bleh!" Here the man spat on the floor. "Oh, dear, don't ask me to eat any of your pies." "Shame, shame," said several of the lawyer's clerks. "Will any gentleman who thinks it a shame be so good as to step forward and say so a little closer?" Everybody shrank back upon this, instead of accepting the challenge, and Mrs. Lovett soon saw that she must, despite all the legal chivalry by which she was surrounded, fight her battle herself. With a look of vehement anger, she cried, "Beware, sir! I am not to be trifled with. If you carry your jokes too far, you will wish that you had not found your way, sir, into this shop." "That, madam," said the tall, stout man, "is surely not possible, when I have the beauty of a Mrs. Lovett to gaze upon, and render the place so exquisitely attractive. But if you will not permit me to have the pleasure of helping you up with the next batch of pies, which, after all, you may find heavier than you expect, I must leave you to do it yourself." "So that I am not troubled any longer by you, sir, at all," said Mrs. Lovett, "I don't care how heavy the next batch of pies may happen to be, sir."
"Very good, madam."
"Upon my word," said a small boy, giving the side of his face a violent rub, with the hope of finding a ghost of a whisker there, "it's really too bad." "Huh? Who's that? Let me get at him." "Oh, no, no. Oh, I mean that it's too bad of Mrs. Lovett, my dear sir. Oh, don't." "Oh, very good. I'm satisfied. Now, madam, you see that even your dear friends here from Lincoln's Inn
Are you from the inn, small boy?
Yes, sir, if you please.
Very good. As I was saying, Mrs. Lovett, you must now of necessity perceive that even your friends from the inn feel that your conduct is really too bad, madam.
Mrs. Lovett, upon this, was so dreadfully angry that she disdained any reply to the stout, impertinent man, but at once she applied herself to the windlass, which worked up the little platform, upon which a whole tray of 100 pies was wont to come up, and began to turn it with what might be called a vengeance. How very strange it was! Sure, the words of the tall, stout, impertinent stranger were prophetic, for never before had Mrs. Lovett found what a job it was to work that handle as upon that night. The axle creaked, and the cords and the pulleys strained and wheezed, but she was a determined woman, and she worked away at it.
"I told you so, my dear madam," said the stranger. "It is more evidently than you can do."
"Peace, sir."
"I'm done. Work away, madam. Only don't say afterwards that I did not offer to help you, that's all."
Indignation was swelling at the heart of Mrs. Lovett, but she felt that if she wasted her breath upon the impertinent stranger, she would have none for the windlass. So setting her teeth, she fagged at it with a strength and a will that if she had not been in a right royal passion, she could not have brought to bear upon it on any account. There was quite an awful stillness in the shop. All eyes were bent upon Mrs. Lovett and the cavity through which the next batch of those delicious pies was coming. Those who had had the good fortune to get one of the first lot had only their appetites heightened by the luxurious feast they had partaken of, while those who had had as yet none actually licked their lips and snuffled up the delightful aroma from the remains of the first batch.
"Two for me, Mrs. Lovett," cried a voice. "One veal for me, three porks, one pork."
The voices grew fast and furious.
"Silence," cried the tall, stout man. "I will engage that everybody shall be fully satisfied, and no one shall leave here without a thorough conviction that his wants in pies has been more than attended to."
The platform could be made to stop at any stage of its upward progress by means of a ratchet, wheel, and a catch. And now Mrs. Lovett paused to take breath. She attributed the unusual difficulty in working the machinery to her own weakness, contingent upon her recent immersion in the Thames.
"Sir," she said between her clenched teeth, addressing the man who was such an eyesore to her in the shop. "Sir, I don't know who you are, but I hope to be able to show you, when I have served these gentlemen, that even I am not to be insulted with impunity."
"Anything you please, madam," he replied, "in a small way. Only don't exert yourself too much." Mrs. Lovett flew to the windlass again, and from the manner in which she now worked at it, it was quite clear that when she had her hands free from that job, she fully intended to make good her threats against the tall, stout man. The young beardless scions of the law trembled at the idea of what might happen. And now the tops of the pies appeared. Then they saw the rim of the large tray upon which they were, and then just as the platform itself was level with the floor of the shop, up flew tray and pies as if something had exploded beneath them, and a tall, slim man sprang upon the counter. It was the cook, who, from the cellars beneath, had laid himself as flat as he could beneath the tray of pies, and so had been worked up to the shop by Mrs. Lovett.
"Gentlemen," he cried, "I am Mrs. Lovett's cook. The pies are made of human flesh."
We shrink. We tremble at the idea of attempting to describe
the scene that ensued in the shop of Mrs. Lovett, contingent upon this frightful apparition, and still more frightful speech of the cook. But our duty to the public, requires that we should say something upon the occasion. If we can do nothing more, we can briefly enumerate what did actually take place in some instances. About 20 clerks rushed into Bell Yard, and there and then, to the intense surprise of passers-by, became intensely sick. The cook with one spring cleared the counter and alighted amongst the customers, and with another spring the tall, impertinent man who had made so many remarks to Mrs. Lovett of an aggravating tendency cleared the counter likewise in the other direction, and alighting close to Mrs. Lovett, he cried, "Madam, you are my prisoner!" For a moment, and only for a moment, the great, the cunning, and the redoubtable Mrs. Lovett lost her self-possession, and staggering back, she lurched heavily against the glass case next to the wall, immediately behind the counter. It was, though, that such an effect was produced upon Mrs. Lovett, and then, with a spring, like an enraged tigress, she caught up a knife that was used for slipping under the pies and getting them cleanly out of the little tins, and rushed upon the tall stranger. Yes, she rushed upon him. But for once in a way, even Mrs. Lovett had met with her match. With a dexterity that only long practice in dealings with a more desperate portion of human nature could have taught him, the tall man closed with her and had the knife out of her hand in a moment. He at once threw it right through the window into Bell Yard, and then holding Mrs. Lovett in his arms, he said, "My dear madam, you only distress yourself for nothing. All resistance is perfectly useless. Either I must take you prisoner, or you me, and I decidedly incline to the former alternative." The knife that had been thrown through the window was not without its object, for in a moment afterwards Mr. Crotchet made his appearance in the shop. "All right, Crotchet," said he who had captured Mrs. Lovett, "first clap the bracelets on this lady." "Here you is," said Crotchet. "Lor, mum, I had an eye on you months and months ago. How is you, mum, and your felons in this here nice evening, hmm?" A knife, oh, for a knife," cried Mrs. Lovett. "Exactly, mum," added Crotchet, as he, with professional dexterity, slipped the handcuffs on her wrists. "Would you like one with an ivory handle, mum, or would anything more common do, mum?" "In the cupboard, in the parlor," said Mrs. Lovett, "there is a letter addressed to me by Sir Richard Blunt. It will be worth your while to save it from the mob. Let me show you where to lay your hands upon it, and if you have any wish to take a greater criminal than I, go to the shop of one Sweeney Todd, a barber in Fleet Street. His number is 69. Seize him, for he is the head of all the criminality you can possibly impute to me. Seize him, and I shall be content." "The man you mention," said Mr. Green, "has been in Newgate an hour nearly."
"Newgate?"
"Yes, we took him first, and then attended to you."
"Todd captured in Newgate?
And I, in fancied security, here remained, wasting the precious moments upon which hung my life? Oh, fool, dulled idiot, a knife! Oh, sirs, I pray you to give me the means of instant death. What can the law do but take my life? What have you all come here and plotted and planned for but to take my life? I will do it. Oh, I pray to you to give me the means, and I will satisfy you and justice and die at once. A knife!"
"Well, you're certainly a rum customer," said Crotchet. "A knife, help me. Why, I can't see one. Will a fork do?"
"Oh, let's get along with her," Crotchet added. "I have her tight. She won't get away. Make way a little."
Mrs. Lovett shrieked as she saw the sea of angry faces before, behind, and on all sides of her. She thought that surely her last hour was come,
and that a far more horrible death than any she had ever calculated upon in her worst moments of depression was about to be hers. Her eyes were bloodshot. She bit her underlip through, and the blood poured from her mouth. She, at each moment that she could gather breath to do so, raised a fearful shriek. And the mob shouted and yelled and swayed to and fro, and the links were tossed from hand to hand, flashing and throwing around them thousands of bright sparks, and people rapidly joined the mob. It took a quarter of an hour to reach the coach from the door of Mrs. Lovett's shop, a distance that in 20 steps anyone might have traversed. And oh, what a quarter of an hour of horrible suffering that was to the wretched woman whose crimes had so infuriated the populace that with one voice they called for her death. The coach door was opened, and Crotchet pushed his prisoner in, and she was safely lodged in Newgate.
"Now, Mum," said Crotchet to Mrs. Lovett, "didn't I say I'd bring her to the old stone jug as safe as ninepence?"
She only looked at him vacantly, and then glaring around her with a shudder, she said,
"And this is Newgate."
"Just a few," said Crotchet. The governor at this moment made his appearance and began to give orders as to where Mrs. Lovett should be placed. A slight change of color came over her face as she said,
"Shall I see Todd?"
"Not at present," said the governor.
"I should like to see him, to forgive him, for no doubt it is to him that I owe the situation. He has betrayed me."
The look which she put on when she uttered the words, "I should like to see him, to forgive him," was so truly demonic that it was quite clear if she did see Todd that whether she were armed or not, she would fly upon him and try to take his life. And although in that she might fail, there would be very little doubt but that in the process of failure she would inflict upon him some very serious injury. The cook and Crotchet made their way to Sir Richard Blunt's office. Sir Richard was at home and anxiously expecting them, so that upon the first hint of their presence, they were introduced to him, and he received the report of the officer with evident satisfaction.
"Thank God," he said, "two of the greatest malefactors the world ever saw are now in the hands of justice."
"Yes," said Crotchet, "they're cotched."
In a few moments the magistrate was alone with the cook. From a cupboard in his room, then, Sir Richard Blunt took wine and other refreshments and laid them before the cook, saying,
"Refresh yourself, my friend, but for your own sake, as your fare has been but indifferent for some time, I beg you to be sparing."
"I will, sir. I owe you much, very much."
"You are free now."
"I am, sir."
"And yet you are very unhappy."
The cook started and changed color slightly. He filled for himself a glass of wine, and after drinking it, he heaved a sigh as he said,
"Sir, I am unhappy. I do not care how soon the world and I part, sir. The hope, the dream of my life has gone from me. All that I lived for, all that I cherished as the brightest expectation of joy in this world, has passed away like a vapor, and left not a rack behind. I am unhappy, and better, far better, would it have been for me if Sweeney Todd had taken my life, or if, by some subtle poison, Mrs. Lovett had shuffled me out of the world. I am unhappy. You already know that I am not exactly what I seem, and that my being in that most abominable woman's employment as a cook was one of those odd freaks of fortune which will at times detract the due order of society and place people in the most extraordinary positions."
"Exactly.
I am, sir, an orphan, and was brought up by an uncle with every expectation that he would be kind and liberal to me as I progressed in years. But he had taken his own course and had made up his mind as to what I was to be. The consequence was, then,
that directly he found me very different from what he wished. He was very angry indeed. And then I put the finishing stroke to his displeasure. By committing the greatest crime that in his eyes I could commit, I fell in love. But he said, "You must give up all love nonsense if you wish to preserve my favor." And then he turned me out of the room.
"And what did you do? Did you give up your love?"
"No, sir. If he had asked me to give up my life, that would have been much easier for me. My uncle and I met very seldom, but there was one upon my track that he paid to follow me and to report my actions to him. And that spy, oh, that I had caught him, that spy made my uncle acquainted with the fact that I continued, despite his prohibition, to meet with the only being who ever awakened in my bosom a tender feeling, and so was abandoned by my relative and left penniless almost. I heard that an expedition was about to start to explore some rich island in the southern sea. If successful, every one who took part in it would be enriched, and if unsuccessful, I could not lose my life in a better cause than in trying to make a happy home for her whom I love. I at once embraced the proposition and became one of the adventurers, much against the inclination of the gentle girl, who in imagination pictured to herself a thousand dangers as involved in the enterprise.
You went?
I did, and with every hope of returning in about a year an independent man. I thought little of the perils I was about to encounter in my voyage. I and the fair girl upon whom I had fixed my best hopes and affections parted, and after many tears and protestations of fidelity, I kept my faith.
And she
broke hers. The principal object of the voyage failed entirely, but by pure accident I got possession of a string of pearls, of very great value indeed, which, provided I could get home in safety, would value in Europe quite a sufficient sum to enable us to live in comfort. But the dangers of the deep assailed us. We were wrecked, and fully believing that I should not survive, I handed the pearls to a stronger comrade and begged him to take them to her whom I had loved, to tell her my fate, and to bid her not weep for me, since I had died happy in the thought that I had achieved something for her. And so my friend and I parted. I was preserved and got on board a merchant vessel bound for England, where I arrived absolutely penniless. But I had a heart full of hope and joy, for if I could but find my poor girl faithful to me, I felt that we might yet be happy, whether my comrade had lived to bring her the pearls or not. I walked from Southampton to London, subsisting on the road as best I could. At length I reached London, tolerably exhausted, as you may suppose, and in anything but a good plight.
"Well, but you found your girl all right, I suppose."
"No, I walked up the Strand, and as some of our happiest interviews had taken place in the Temple Gardens, I could not resist turning aside for a moment to look at the old familiar spot, when what do you think was the sight that met my eyes? I really can't say. The first object that met my eyes in that Temple Gardens was the being whom I loved, so fondly leaning upon the arm of a man in military undress, leaning, did I say, upon his arm. She was almost upon his breast. He was actually supporting her with one of his arms around her waist.
And you then only walked away.
With such a pang at my heart at the moment, as I wonder did not kill me, I walked away and left her to her own conclusions. I found myself tired, worn out, famished, opposite Mrs. Lovett's shop window, and the steam of those abominable pies began to tempt me so much that I went into the shop, and after some talk, I actually accepted the situation of cook to her. And there, but for you, should have breathed my last.
Not a doubt of it. And now, my young friend, you know that I am a police magistrate, and I dare say you have heard a great deal about my sources of information,
and the odd way in which I find out things when folks think they keep them a profound secret. You have told me all your history, but you have thought proper, as you were, if you please, quite justified in doing, to withhold your name. I have done so, but I hardly know why. I will tell it to you, however, now. Hold. I know it. Your name is Margan Gestry. I know more than that. The name of the young lady who you believe played you such a trick is Joanna Oakley.
Margan Gestry, for it was indeed no other, sprang to his feet, exclaiming,
Are you man or devil, that you know what I have never breathed to you?
Thornhill is dead.
But I can tell you more of other people. I can tell you that Joanna Oakley was faithful to you. I can tell you that she mourned your loss as you would wish her to mourn it, knowing how you would mourn hers. I can tell you that the gentleman's arm she was leaning upon was Thornhill's friend, and the fact of her having to be supported by him at the unlucky moment when you saw this was solely owing to the deep grief she was plunged into upon your account.
Oh, no, no.
I say yes, it was so, Mr. Ingestry. And if you had at that moment stepped forward, you would have saved yourself much misery, and you would have saved her such heartbreaking thoughts and such danger as it will frighten you to listen to.
Upon hearing all this, poor Margan Gestry turned very faint and fell back in his chair, looking so pale and wan that Sir Richard Blunt was compelled to go across the room to hold him up. After giving him a glass of wine, he recovered, and with a deep sigh he said,
And so I have wronged her after all. Oh, my Joanna, I'm unworthy of you.
That, said Sir Richard, is entirely a subject for the young lady's own consideration.
Now, Margan Gestry looked curiously in the face of Sir Richard Blunt, as with marked emphasis he said now, but he had not long to wait for an explanation of what it meant. A door at the back of the room was flung open, and Joanna sprang forward with a cry of joy. In another moment she was in the arms of Margan Gestry, and Sir Richard Blunt had left the room.
It would be quite impossible, if we had the will to attempt it, for us to go through the scene that took place between Joanna Oakley and Margan Gestry in the magistrate's parlor. For about half an hour they quite forgot where they were, or that there was anyone in the world but themselves. At the end of the period of time, though, Sir Richard Blunt gently walked into the room.
Well, he said, have you considerable understanding about that military man in the Temple Gardens?
Joanna sprang towards the magistrate, and placing her arm upon his breast, she kissed him on the cheek.
Sir, she said, you are our very dear friend, and I love you as I love my father.
God bless you, said Sir Richard. You have, by these few words, more than repaid me for all that I have done. Are you happy?
Very, very happy.
So very happy, sir, said Ingestry, as his eyes glistened through tears of joy,
that I can hardly believe in its reality.
And yet you are both so poor.
Ah, sir, what is poverty when we shall be together?
Well, said Sir Richard as he opened his desk, since you are not to be knocked down by poverty, what say you to riches? Do you know these, Mr. Ingestry?
Why, that is my string of pearls.
Yes, I took it from Todd's escritoire myself, and they are yours and Joanna's. Will you permit me to always call you Joanna?
Very well. This string of pearls, I have ascertained, is worth a sufficient sum to place you both very far above all the primary exigencies of life. It will be necessary to produce them at the trial of Sweeney Todd, but after that event they will be handed to you to do what you please with them, when you can realize them at once and be happy enough with the proceeds.
Our tale is now drawing to a close.
Sweeney Todd suffered the extreme penalty of the law, which Mrs. Lovett avoided by poisoning herself. Mark and Jestery and Joanna were united, and no one was more welcome at the wedding than Sir Richard Blunt and Colonel Jeffrey. Join me next season for more tales of the unseen and the unknown here on Stories from the Shadows.